Emerson Show live from Portland. It's 503-733-2970. Another day where we need 6 hours. I haven't even stuck this thing up Scotty's nose yet.
We've got to get to that today.
I know. All right, so here's what's going to happen. We'll go to the Ministry of Truth, then Peter Carlin, then we'll break, then more Tim, then Scotty will clean out his nose with this saline solution. Let's start it now, shall we?
And now, from the Ministry of Truth, this is Tim Riley.
Bam. The bomb squad has been called out to a Beaverton neighborhood.
This, after somebody found some dangerous trash. Somebody put a box of blasting caps, fuses, and gunpowder near the dumpster at King's Court Apartments. They don't know if there was a bomb planted there to go off, or somebody was just careless with some mad scientist-type invention.
Really, and
nobody
was hurt.
How you know it's a terrible place. They call it King's Court. Anything that has a name like King's Court is, of course, a place where nothing resembling, nothing king-like ever happens there.
Where is that, Tim? Is it on Division? I think I've driven by there.
No, it's in Beaverton.
Oh. So like I think it's the King's Court on Division.
Call it like Pleasant Brook or something, and it's always a crack house.
Well, next to my my rental property, which is in a fine old-fashioned working-class neighborhood in North Portland, there's a street right next door called Ida Street, and right next to it are the Princess Ida Apartments.
The Princess. And I'm sure that everybody there is a princess. I'm sure that everybody everybody there is royalty.
Meanwhile, the president is again promising to veto a war funding bill. The president criticized lawmakers for leaving town for recess without doing something about military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Whatever option they choose, would hope they'd get home, get a bill, and get it to my desk. And if it has artificial timetables of withdrawal, or if it cuts off funding for troops, or if it tells our generals how to run a war, I'll veto it.
Yeah, we can't be telling people what to do. Congress needs to provide funds to fight our enemies. And if they don't, they're just wasting everyone's time.
It has now been 57 days since I requested that Congress pass emergency funds for our troops. Instead of passing clean bills that fund our troops on the front lines, the House and Senate have spent this time debating bills that undercut the troops.
Now, here's the thing. And, of course, no one wishes to put the troops in harm's way, and everybody wishes that. In fact,
we want to get them out of harm's way and bring them back here.
I was just going to say, in fact,
there's no reason for them to be in harm's way.
I think all the people in this room would like to take them completely out of harm's way by just getting them out of that goddamned fool war.
That's supporting the troops.
Getting them out from where the landmines are and bringing them back here. So, since that's clearly not going to happen, though, I have to say that I am sort of intrigued in an intellectual sense about what's going to happen if the Congress just finally is able to dig in their heels and pass this funding bill, which they probably won't because Bush is going to veto, and there's no way they can muster the 2/3 to override the veto. But I am curious if the Congress was able to cut off funding for the war. That's like the biggest of all political showdowns right there. I mean, that's an absolute Mexican standoff. If Bush is just saying, well, look, we're going to stay regardless, and if Congress is fine and they just zip up their wallet and go home and there's no more money, I'm really curious about whether I wish I could run some sort of simulation on that.
Then we do peace with honor.
I really would like to see whether Bush would have the stones to keep the troops there without any funding. I'd like to see. Because I honestly don't know whether he would or not. I really don't know. He talks so much about needing to support the troops, but about how we're going to stay and how he won't let the Democratic Congress end the war and bring the troops home. If they're able to cut off the funding, I really am perversely fascinated about whether or not he would just leave the troops there with no money. I mean, I honestly don't know whether he would or not. I wish I could just get someone from the White House right here and just dose them with truth serum and make them answer it. Because that's a thing I really am fascinated to know the answer to. And ever since that listener brought it up, that's a thing that I think about all the time.
All right, here's Tim Riley. Now, the president says Democrats loaded down the bill with vegetable funding and unnecessary items.
The only way the Democrats were able to pass their bill in the first place was to load the bill with pork and other spending that has nothing to do with the war. Here's what one leading Democrat in the House said, quote, a lot of things had to go into that bill that certainly those of us who respect great legislation did not want there.
Democrats are irresponsible.
Without approval of the supplemental funds in April, we will be forced to take increasingly draconian measures which will impact Army readiness and impose hardships on our soldiers and their families. It's irresponsible for the Democratic leadership in Congress to delay for months on end while our troops in combat are waiting for the funds.
I think I speak for everybody, though, and especially for the political junkies out there. When I say that I want to see him put to the test, I really do. Can I just tell you this, and then I swear to God,
I think somebody's getting the straitjacket ready, because eventually they're going to need it.
Well, I'm not saying that the president is engaging in late-night Coke binges at the White House, but clearly someone has gone a little wacky. Someone has gone a little wacky and become paranoid and filled with hubris in that place. Those are, of course, symptoms of frequent and heavy use of cocaine, which I am in no way accusing the president of engaging in. I'm sorry for ending a sentence with a preposition like that, but you know what I'm saying. I'm just saying, there are no words that thrill me. You know, like every now and again, like in the 2000 election, this happened when they used the words, it's a constitutional crisis. I love things like that. I love constitutional crises. I love to see just these weird, uncharted water situations that confront the government when they have to deal with some insane scenario that they never once anticipated, which is clearly what Bush is coming up on later in the year. So the whole thing warms the cockles of my heart. All right, we will revisit the Ministry of Truth here at the bottom of the hour. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show, with a heart full of hate and a head full of warm cherry filling, Peter Carlin, TV critic for the Oregonian. Hello, sir.
Hey, hi.
What's up with you, brother?
Well, I heard there's something that you don't want to talk about, so I can't talk about it.
Oh, see, I knew you were going to be a dick. I knew you were going to be an ass about this. Fine, we'll talk about Dennis Miller. Fine.
Nope.
No, there's no point. I knew.
Let's do it.
Here's the thing. As soon as it, because you had sent me, there's a backstory here.
Backstory.
You'd been gone for a while. You were in Hawaii.
That's true.
Being held hostage by Vincent Price. You came back, and he sent me this email like, hey, Dick, what's up with Peter, with Dennis Miller?
No, and, I didn't say that.
He did. He said something like that.
I didn't use the...
It was something like a-hole program director.
No. It was just Mr. Program Director.
Mr. Program Director.
You can't imagine the rest, which, anyway.
Anyway, and so I had told Scotty, I'm like, you know, we've kind of tried, because here's the thing I've learned. This is the thing that I've learned in being, you know, here and then also being, because I've been a program director for like 10, 12 years, something like that, 13 years. And so I don't talk about it a lot because nobody really cares about nobody cares about the behind the scenes programming, whatever, the station. But this thing I learned is that whenever there's any sort of a show change, lineup change, change with anything, like if you're the guy who's, you know, kind of steering the station and kind of making some of those decisions, and then you're also doing a show, the thing I've learned is you have to absolutely keep those separate, because otherwise what it becomes is like every show becomes a four-hour town hall where people weigh in with their thoughts on like every liner you're playing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Every jingle you decide to add, every commercial people don't like, whatever. The whole 4 hours just becomes, I'd like to talk about that... That show you have on at 3 to 5 a.m., can we spend a lot of time discussing that? And then it just takes over the whole show. And then that's, you know, and then you can't ever get anything else done. So when we made the, when we pushed Stephanie Miller back to being a live show and put the Dennis Miller show in, I told Scott, I'm like, hey, people call and they want to yell or, you know, shriek or whatever about Dennis Miller, or they want to be, you know, think it's great. Fine, but we're probably not going to talk about it on the air. Send them my voicemail. And that's fine. You know, people called, they left me voicemails or emails, and I responded to all of them. We do whatever. But then you were gone. You sent me this email like, so, what's up with this Dennis Miller business? And I was like, God, if I let Peter come on and talk about it after not having talked about it for like a week, then it's just going to uncork just like 500 calls about it.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
So I told Scotty, I'm like, when you get Peter on, just tell him that, you know, we'll just steer away from that and we'll just talk about some other point. But I knew, here's the thing, as those words were leaving my mouth,
right,
as I said, Scotty, tell Peter that we'll just steer away from that. I knew. I knew my own name, like it was encoded in my DNA. I knew that you would open your appearance on this show by saying, so, I understand there's something I'm not supposed to bring up, and I'd like to thank you for not disappointing me.
Well, it was just, you know, it's like that slow ball across the middle of the plate.
I know.
You can't, you know, it's in your DNA. You can't not... it up.
It's fine. So you know what? So I'll give you a free show. Ask me anything you want to ask me.
Okay, this is what I really want to ask. Is there a school where some DJs go to learn how to talk as though they were also simultaneously laughing all the time?
You mean like when they say, this is Peter Carlin's...
when they sort of say, greatest hits of the 60s and 70s. Because there's a station in Hawaii where it was like all the disc jockeys, unless they were all doing nitrous all the time,
right,
they're just constantly, it's like it was almost breathtaking. And then they would have conversations, you know, like when you're switching from one guy to the next, or if there's like a team of them on in the morning, where they're just constantly laughing. And I'm thinking, they're not that amused. They couldn't possibly be that amused.
Not without having some clinical ailments.
Exactly.
I have actually made that observation in the past, and the funny thing is when they're, and by funny I don't mean ha-ha, I mean retarded, is when they do that a lot about things, like they'll say things, they'll laugh, while saying where the words themselves have no comedic value at all.
Yeah.
Like, it's sort of the laugh is just sort of like one of the few colors in their palette. And DJs on classic rock stations will do this a lot. Well, they'll backsell a record. They'll announce the artist as the record is ending.
Mm.
And they'll throw in, as you say, the speaking chuckle, as I call it.
Yeah.
And it'll be something like this. They'll come out and go, 93.3 KGON. That's the Black Crowes right there. They're hard to handle. Yeah. Coming up, it's like, what is funny about that?
Yeah.
It's not a joke. It's not a limerick. It's not any sort of knock-knock humor. There's nothing fundamentally or inherently funny about those sentences. So, all right.
That's what I wanted to know. And this Dennis Miller business. Now, is it a political show?
I don't know. He spent an hour talking. I mean, he's obviously, he talks about politics, but he spent an hour talking about the NCAA the other day, so.
Oh, that's cool.
It's, you know, I mean, whatever. I mean, we try not to, like, lean too hard on the show, but I'm a big political junkie, too, so we talk about it a lot here.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing about that would intrigue me, he sort of fell off the face of the earth after they canceled his MSNBC, or was that what he was on?
It was CNBC.
CNBC show.
CNBC.
But when that show was on, he was such a vehement and in-your-face, finger down your throat, a supporter of all things Bush administration, and now that all that stuff has kind of fallen apart, or so much of it has, it would be interesting to hear if he has moderated his position or even apologized for being such a dick about it all.
I think I'm not his shrink. I think in my opinion, I mean, he's like anybody, you know, any recent converts are always the biggest zealots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like anybody who's recently converted to something is they're always the ones who are the most, like Phil Hendry, who has retired from radio, but you know, Hendry is like Dennis Miller, Hendry and like Tom Likas, a self-identified libertarian. But I remember Hendry was a full-on screaming government off my back libertarian, but was and presumably still is just the biggest fan of the Iraq War. Like all guys who would suddenly flip to it, it was like he was shrieking about it. I mean, just red hot about it. And the thing about Dennis Miller is, and this is the thing, and I, not to just, again, just bore people with this sort of mechanics of the whole thing, but I mean, you know, I do the show, and then it's like, you know, the rest of the day, I go tend to the actual station business and so forth, and I do my very best. I don't get into fights with people about it. I don't like to argue with people who call they call my desk during the day, or if they email me, you know, like as the program director, to bitch about Dennis Miller. I don't fight with them about it. I just take their comments and say thanks and, you know, whatever. And the thing about Dennis Miller that's intriguing, though, is he's sort of a good Rorschach in a way, because it used to be between the left and the right that, like, you'd have a single defining issue, and it was abortion for a long time, where abortion was the one issue where your stance on that determined whether you were, in the view of conventional wisdom, a Republican or a Democrat, a liberal or a conservative.
Mm.
And now it's not that. Now it's the war. Because you think about Dennis Miller, who is pro-gay marriage, pro-choice, pro-stem cell research, pro-drug legalization, but he's a big fan of George Bush's war on terror.
Well, he was a huge fan of George Bush, just plain and simple, because I think he was one of those 9/11 convert guys, you know, and his whole thing, I think he just got off on the sort of the manliness of it all, you know, because of the strutting around and all that stuff. I mean, that seemed to be a huge, I mean, because obviously his whole demeanor is so man, you know, macho, and in the way, you know, I mean, his humor is, it's that sort of teasing, towel snapping, locker room type stuff.
Towel snapping,
yeah.
Just say it. Just say he longs to give warm oil massages to others.
One could surmise.
You can say it. So it's, anyway, so I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, he's, I will say this. I mean, all, I will, just a final and an observation, not just for you, but for the people who sort of, you know, because, look, I hate to, as Dennis Miller himself would say, and now you've uncorked it, I hate to get off on a rant here, but I will tell you.
I know, because I want
to
hear about The Sopranos.
We'll talk about The Sopranos in like 30 seconds.
Okay.
I will just say this, that as anybody who listens to this station, you know, the other shows on the station, knows that we don't make any programming decisions on the station based on political ideology, which you could tell by just looking at the sort of panoply of programming that we have here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it clearly we're not some, like, flaming right-wing station, or we wouldn't have, you know, like, Tom Likas would be the first thing to have gone if that were the case. But I had some point. What was it? Blah, 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 Dennis Miller. Oh, I will say this. He's a funny guy, though, and I was, for a while, the comedy had sort of been bleached out of him, because I have this whole thing about how conservatives just typically aren't funny. That's why Rush Limbaugh was such a revelation all those years ago when he was at the peak of his game. Mm-hmm. Because Republicans typically are just like the least humorous. They're just not funny. Conservatives, as a rule, typically are just never funny. There's something about being conservative that it's like, I don't know what it is, man. It's like being conservative. It's like that's a chemical solution in which humor does not live. And if you've seen that hideous Fox answer to The Daily Show, which is, goddamn, that's the worst thing I've ever seen. That is like pounding 10 penny nails into my scrotum. That show, it's so bad.
That's a whole other show.
So, anyway, but so that's why Rush Limbaugh was so great, because he was a funny conservative. And, you know, Dennis Miller, for what it's worth, his comedy's bounced back a lot. He's a pretty funny guy. So,
yeah.
Oh, we got to talk about The Sopranos, though, or Sarah's going to string me up. So, first of all, though, S.H.I.E.L.D. So I watched The S.H.I.E.L.D. last night, season 6 premiere. Is it true that this season of The S.H.I.E.L.D. was originally intended to be the second half of last season?
Well, yeah, but you know, they kind of say that stuff sometimes, but you're never sure whether that has any meaning beyond contractual meaning, because sometimes what that comes down to, I think part of the reason why the Sopranos seasons are, this season is, what's starting now is supposedly the second half of last season, is because they had their actors and everyone wired in for X number of seasons, and if they called this another season, they would have had to renegotiate or extend the contract. Oh, I heard there was some...
That's handy.
Yeah, precisely.
All right.
And the fact, and I maybe seasons are defined as 22 hours, like even if you are on Showtime and you're only doing a 13-hour season, but they did, you know, however many, 12 and last year, and then they're going to do 8 or 9 this time, and it's like, nope, one season, pal. Just half of it's a year later.
So before we move on to The Sopranos, so let's, a couple of S.H.I.E.L.D. things. So this, first of all, the S.H.I.E.L.D. last night was just fantastic.
Yeah.
That look on Shane Vendrell's face when he realizes that he killed Lem for nothing.
Go.
I mean, God,
my bad.
It's like being kicked in the stomach. That show, just when you think it's run out of ways to be dark,
right?
And that you can't. I was talking to somebody about this earlier. When you think they've run out of ways to paint those guys into a corner,
yeah.
And I like the fact that Forrest Whitaker as John Kavanaugh, that they didn't just flip the switch and make him turn corrupt and become crazy. That they have actually, they have really laid the groundwork with that character for being a by-the-book, follow-the-rules, absolutely pure and virtuous cop, and they have very convincingly turned him into a corrupt cop, as you would say, corrupt in pursuit of justice.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just fascinating. It's genius. And the fact that show just refuses to be sentimental.
Right.
Like when Corinne Mackey has that run-in with Danny, the cop who has the baby that's probably Vic's.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no sentimentality at all. I mean, it's like they're just two weasels fighting in a bag. I mean, you know what I mean? It's just, that show is so brutal, and it runs the risk always of becoming a self-parody, but it never does.
Mm-hmm.
They have such a fine touch. So is it, they're going to finish out this batch of episodes, and then one more season, and then it's done?
Right.
Well, I hope they don't screw it up. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
Because I want it to end strong. This, though, is going to be the final season of The Sopranos, and The Sopranos and Entourage both premiere this Sunday, right?
That's true.
And so what do you know about this season of The Sopranos, without giving you spoilers, if you know that, what do you know about this season of The Sopranos? Is there anything you can say that's not going to be a spoiler?
Well, I've seen the first 2 hours of it, what I can say is it's really, really good, and it's, I'm just trying to think how to describe it. I mean, when we left off, I mean, Tony was still kind of in his post near-death
right.
phase and trying to come to terms with this new kind of empathy, this new sense of life that he had and what that was going to mean for him. And eventually, I think it seemed, it comes to pass that it doesn't mean all that much, because I don't think he can really see beyond the life that he's already established, or that was established for him. And so we can just, you know, so the after effects of that, the consequences of that decision are playing out. Let's put it that way.
I have to say, I watched the HBO rebroadcast season 5 of The Sopranos, which I, at the time, had been sort of disappointed in. I didn't think it had held up, and I thought it was not as good as previous seasons. But, you know, watching it again, there's just... That show is so nuanced.
Mm-hmm.
And the characters are so rich with facets. And I was watching that episode where Tony is seducing Juliana Margulies and then he can't bring himself to go through with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's unbuttoning his shirt and he looks down and he has a flashback to Carmella.
Right.
And he goes home and he's so angry about the smoked turkey and the whatever. And, you know, it's just, the characters there are just so layered.
And yeah.
Especially Carmella, who I could never get my head around whether Carmella Soprano is a good person or not, ever.
Well, that begins to become much more clear as in these first couple hours of the new season.
Really?
Well, it's just interesting where she is. I mean, she's always been as deeply, you know, more in denial than anyone else. But then you begin to realize exactly how, you know, she's not as blind to these things as as she has made it seem. And it seems to become clear, or did to me anyway, that she sees very clearly and knows very clearly what's going on, and you know, in her husband's life and in their family. There's a real hilarious set piece in the first episode where she and Tony are up with Bobby Bacala and Janice, Tony's sister,
right,
for the weekend, celebrating Tony's birthday, and they start playing this kind of drunken game of Monopoly, and of course, you know, Tony is just a reflexive cheater, and then they have this whole conversation with Bobby about whether they should or shouldn't put the fines, all those the money that's supposed,
right,
to go back to the bank into free parking for someone to win, you know, the free parking jackpot, which isn't in the rules, and he points that out, and as Carmella says, you know, to paraphrase Carmella, she says, you know, screw Parker Brothers, play the game, you know.
Right, fantastic.
So is the episode on Sunday, is it just an hour? You've seen the first two episodes?
Yeah.
Okay.
The thing about this, about Carmella Soprano, that's so fascinating to me, is how she is. And I was thinking about that whole thing with Vito and we vanished, and how she's, you know, the sounding board, mm-hmm, for her friend, and with Ginny Sacramone and her having to sell the house because Johnny gets sent up the river and so forth. How Carmella Soprano is always seemingly distraught by and yet absolutely titillated over all of the drama and bad things that befall the people around her.
Yeah.
And so she is just such a duality where on the one hand she's so nurturing and maternal and wants to, oh, you poor dear, you know, that's terrible, come over, tell me all about it, let me take care of you. But you can tell she is so deeply titillated by,
mm-hmm,
and just almost like, almost in like this weirdly sexual way, like it's really almost turned on,
yes,
by the fact that all these terrible things happen to the people in her life.
And Tony, I think, notes that at some point when they are having a frank and useful discussion about,
yeah,
something.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And, yeah, that she likes the fact that he's a bruiser and that he, beats up people and kills people to get what he wants.
There was this moment, and again, last season, where she is buttoning up his shirt, and he's going out late at night, and he's going over to seduce Juliana Margulies, and she, mm-hmm, she says, where are you going? And he says, oh, I got a real estate thing. And it's like 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And he's like, I got a real estate thing, and she is dressing him. She's buttoning his shirt for him to go over to some hoe's house. And she says, where are you going? And he says, oh, I got a real estate thing. And she looks up, and they connect eyes while she's buttoning the shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, there's this, I mean, I could sit and look at her face for like an hour and never figure out whether she knows or doesn't know or doesn't want to know.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
Well, they also get into this. She's still kind of pondering what happened to Adriana.
Right.
It almost seems to suggest that that might be a flashpoint somewhere down, not so far down the line. Because she still is trying to work out what did happen to Adriana. And, you know, and of course everyone's lying through their teeth,
sure,
at her about that.
So. Any Johnny Sack this season, to the best of your knowledge?
Oh, yeah, totally. Oh,
fantastic. He's my favorite character apart from Tony. He really is.
Yeah.
So.
He's not well.
Well, because because that guy's just a big ball of stress. That's his whole thing. He's constantly just like one argument away from a stroke.
Yeah.
Let's talk. You are an Entourage fan, are you not?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Entourage is, that show is so good and could have turned bad after the first season. I mean, it seemed like, you know, every time, because it's like, how long can you watch a guy whose life is perfect? You know, and how long can you watch a guy who's just rich and famous and he's got women everywhere and his friends are living in a massive house? But you know what? They make it work somehow.
Yeah.
This is season four. Is it hold up?
Yeah, I've seen the first six episodes of this season. That they sent, and it's really good. I really enjoyed it. You know, and I mean, just Ari. I mean, to me, that show's all about Ari. You know,
totally.
I mean, he's the most fascinating character on the show.
He's sort of like, you know, the President Bartlett on The West Wing, where he was originally just supposed to be a very rare, every now and again, recurring role. But they clearly figured out that he was where the money was,
right,
in that show. Just one big, final, big, broad question. I know you've got to run, but I saw on the front of this month's Vanity Fair, there's a great, beautiful, like a gatefold sort of cover of the Sopranos family and all of the people who've been on the show. And they refer to the Sopranos as the greatest TV show in American history. And your first thought on that?
Probably right.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of...
It's a whole other game. I mean, it's a whole other... But again, I mean, it's cinematic. I mean, it is just a, you know, it's a kind of, you know, video literature or something. I mean, they play, you know, they're just... They have so much more time and I think so much more money and so much more, you know, they can really make every moment sing. And as you said, you know, you can go back and watch and rewatch those episodes and new layers emerge. But, you know... Matt Rausch, the critic for TV Guide, had a great observation in the most recent episode of that magazine, where he says that The Shield is great pulp fiction.
Yeah.
But Sopranos is literature.
It's true. The Sopranos really does. You do get the sense when you watch it that you're watching this sort of masterwork.
Yeah.
It is true. All right. The Sopranos and Entourage both debut this Sunday. Peter Carlin, read them in print in the Oregonian or online at OregonLive.com. Any other cheap shots you want to take while you're here?
See, we got the Dennis Miller thing done. No, I think I'm good for now.
All right, fantastic. We'll talk to you next week, sir.
All right.
There you go. Peter Carlin, ladies and gentlemen. Take a break here. We'll come back with Tim Riley at the Ministry of Truth. It's 503-733-2970. Don't go anywhere. The Rick Emerson Show continues next. True. Do you pay by the minute on your phone?
Well, if it's not Verizon to Verizon, then I pay a little bit more. Plus, if you're going to be in the bathroom, I don't want you to drop it in the toilet.
I'm not going
to
drop it in the toilet.
I love that.
Don't you pay
a sledgehammer?
Do you pay a flat fee for your cell phone usage?
I don't know. I haven't paid my bill in a few months.
I totally just pay a flat fee. It's 2007. You can't possibly be paying by the minute on your cell phone.
No, I'm not paying by the minute, but I only get a certain amount of minutes a month that aren't Verizon, you know, like Verizon to Verizon.
Oh, I see. All right.
Yeah.
Well,
so if you keep using my phone to run around everywhere, then those are all my...
Scotty J. You're
not going to amount to jack squat!
Scotty, please summon him to the studio. Scotty's noting snippily that you can't get a program because you won't pay your bill.
I just find it so funny that you keep forgetting your cell phone upstairs every time we need to use a phone to run around somewhere.
It's charging.
Yeah, sure.
Hi, Scotty. How you doing?
Doing great, everybody.
What did you say to Rick, Scotty?
Oh, I just told him that what you were trying to say basically is you're not on a month-to-month program, right? You're on a pay-as-you-go deal?
Yes, I buy my phone at 7-Eleven.
That's what happens when you don't pay your bill.
He's a drug dealer on the side. All right, Scotty, it's nose cleaning time.
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it
no.
is. Yes. Get that nose in here.
I thought we were going to do it bright and early in the morning.
No, we're going to do it now.
All scrubbed up and ready to go.
No, we're going to do it now.
No.
We're going to do it now.
Okay.
All right, we need your phone.
You need my phone?
Yeah, I left mine upstairs.
Why am I going to snivel all over it?
No, because I got to call it. I'm going to be in the bathroom with you when we do it. I got to call in and give the play-by-play.
Oh, my God.
The blow-by-blow, one might say.
have you read the directions?
I got the directions right here. Come on, let's talk more walk. Mm. All right. Thank you. In the meantime, here's Tim Riley, the Ministry of...
And now, from the Ministry of Truth, this is Tim Riley.
Forests burned down. They'll go back on their own. That's a result of a new survey from the Oregon State University. They found out that after the forest burned down, the forest fires, trees come back by themselves. They don't even touch them.
The earth is not fragile.
Right. In the meantime, a very disturbing story out of South Florida where a three-year-old boy is recovering from a snake bite to the face.
Oh!
It happened at a Miami Seaquarium booth where people posed for pictures of the boa. However, something went terribly wrong this time. The snake wrapped himself around the boy's neck and snapped at him. The snake is still posing for pictures at Seaquarium. They don't want to disappoint the kids.
Of course not.
And a disturbing story out of New Orleans. Five fifth graders facing criminal charges after four of them had sex in front of the other students after the teacher left them unsupervised for 15 minutes. Two are 11-year-old girls and a 12-year-old boy. And customers getting takeout pizza in Cincinnati are getting something extra with their pepperoni and mushrooms. Wanted posters on the pizza boxes. Apparently, it's working quite well. Order a pizza and try to find Cincinnati's most wanted.
Pizza?
I barely knew her.
That doesn't even work. All right, let me see if I can... Hello?
Hello?
All right. Oh, look at you.
All right, hold on.
There's a slight delay.
Do you have it on speaker?
No.
I don't know. All right, Scott, are you ready?
I guess.
All right. Here, hold this nose cleaning solution, please.
Oh, man.
All right. Why don't you do one more while Scott and I are making the long trek to the bathroom?
Oh.
I'm a little nervous. I feel like a whole intercom, drinking too much water, Scotty dies thing.
You know this is a medically, this is a licensed product.
All right.
All right. Let's do one more here, and then, all right.
The sister of a man dying of leukemia is refusing to donate bone marrow to the British man, Simon Pretty. The father of three told the Daily Mail that his sister Helen Pretty would not donate her bone marrow, which is a perfect match and could save his life. Without the donation, Pretty could be dead by the end of the year. That would leave behind his lovely wife Jacqueline and their children. Penny is receiving aggressive chemotherapy treatments and hopes that in the meantime some match might be found. The National Bone Marrow Registry would not provide any matches and doctors are now looking for international databases. I'm on death row. End of story.
I want you to know, by the way, that Scotty doesn't want the door shut. Doesn't want to be alone in the bathroom with me. All right, are we ready?
Yes.
I guess so. I'm really glad I'm not in there.
All right, so here's the deal. Scotty, gently blown nose. Use a, okay, there's a, yeah, get a tissue. I'm following now the instructions on the salt air sinus relief. Oh, that's not, oh, that's disgusting.
Ew, what?
It's all wet and cloggy sounding.
Scotty's
all right,
nose?
Remove cap from top of bottle.
Oh.
Remove inner seal. I've done all of this. Okay, Scotty, hold salt air sinus relief bottle upright in palm with bellows facing away from you.
Is bellows the pumpy part?
Yeah, like that,
yeah,
exactly.
Like a bellows.
Bend forward over a sink, Scotty, so you are looking at the sink bottom. Crouch down. All right, bend forward over the sink.
Crouch down.
All right, so you're looking at the sink bottom.
Yeah.
You screw and see that you gotta. You can be wacky if you want, but this is going to be painful if you don't do it right. All right.
What's the pump all about?
Okay, we'll get to the pump. He's asking what the pump is for. It's the pump. Bend forward over the sink so you're looking at the bottom of the sink, all right?
Yeah.
Gently hold the spout up to one nostril, aiming toward the back of your head. So that's, yes, so it's aiming at the back of your head.
Now remember, you continue to breathe through your mouth.
Yeah, do not breathe in through your nose.
Yeah, don't breathe through your nose, Scotty. Breathe through your mouth. Okay, squeeze the pump or bellows with your fingers to dilute the solution into your nose. Do not inhale while squeezing. All right?
Oh,
my God.
What?
Ah, jeez.
What did he do?
How about you put up there?
I think you're supposed to keep doing it.
Okay.
Until it comes out the other side.
Like swim it in a pool and get the chlorine up your nose. After several seconds, the solution will come outside your nose and
yeah, tell him to stop.
Or opposite nostril.
Tell him to stop talking. That doesn't sound right.
Okay.
You're not supposed to be able to talk when you're doing it.
That hurts.
Okay, repeat this process.
On the other side?
Yes, on the opposite nostril.
Oh, Jesus.
Until you're barely conscious.
It's like swimming in a pool with your nose. God, that hurts.
Okay, he's not repeating the process.
I just hear him saying it hurts.
Right. Okay, I'm trying to do it.
It only hurts the first time.
Up there.
It won't stay up there anymore, he says. All right, Scotty, you're not crying.
My eyes are crying. It's painful.
I think we can all agree that you're not sucking it up and taking one for the team.
It's literally like diving into a swimming pool, going to 12 feet, and sucking it up.
Here's the problem, Kate. Here's the problem. You're not leaving this thing plugged into your nose. You can't squeeze in and pull it out because it runs back out of your nose. No, don't. Okay. Put that into your right nostril. Now, after you squeeze it, just leave it there.
Okay.
Okay, keep squeezing.
I'm sure you keep going down the bottom, though. No, it doesn't run back in. Keep going. Ow! Oh, you have never seen anything this disgusting in your life.
Okay.
That's it.
Oh, you are not leaving.
You can lift it. You can't see it. You can see it.
I am never putting that thing anywhere near my body. I'm gonna burn this. I'm gonna incinerate this nose thing when we're done.
Totally cleared everything up, though.
Yeah. Feel better?
I don't know if I feel better, but it certainly cleared it out.
All right, I'm gonna walk back to the studio now. Let's throw this away. Oh, good God Almighty!
Oh my God! Stop talking.
All right, hold on. I'm gonna walk back to the studio. Okay. All right, I'm heading back down the hallway now. All right. Hold on.
All right.
I don't want to hear about it.
Boy, that was.
Okay.
Turn this off. All right. There we go.
There you go.
Boy, that was disgusting. You don't even want to know what comes out of that guy's head.
I don't want to know.
Let me tell you what came out of that guy's head. No, sorry. Okay. He was clearly not enjoying that. That was not a... I don't care what it says. That is not a pain-free procedure.
Okay, I'm so glad I didn't do it.
Like so many other things, it only hurts... It hurts more the first time you do it. Once you learn to do it, it hurts less each time. You know what I'm talking about. All right. Yeah. It was just sort of like, You know those big bottles of Carol syrup? Imagine you have one of those up inside your head. All right, we're back after this. Don't go anywhere.
Jenny has traffic.
All right, I'm all nervous, but here's my rap. Ahem. All right, you're gonna have a good drive today. There ain't no problems on the major roadways. Looking at country club, things will look pretty good like Robin Hood. Now I'm moving across the triad, yo. It ain't too bad, no. Now things look nice on 68, and I know you ain't gonna be late. So that was your traffic wrap today. Man, let's get some weather from my weather girl, Austin Cavanaugh. Come on, give us a weather boy, give it to us, word.
Oh,
there you go.
Oh boy, Jenny, it's weather guy, by the way. That is something.
Cassidy, I don't know what else to say, except...
You're not going to amount to Jack Squad!
Welcoming now the Rick Emerson Show on Trepid PA, Scotty J. Hello, sir.
How's it going?
How's the nose?
Hi, Scotty.
That was really disgusting. It was not until I realized that you had to keep filling your head until it then ran out the other side. It, like, went over the top like a paddle wheel and came down and started churning out all the contents of your sinuses. That's disgusting is what that is, that product. Yeah. I don't think I'm going to use that. I think I'm going to pass.
Sure, you'll be okay when you do it.
I don't think so. You sounded like you were in pain.
No, come on. It's over now. I feel great.
You do not. The you pain... want me to suffer like you.
No, the pain's gone. It was fun.
Do you feel better?
Yeah, that sounded like a hoot. Yeah. Can I jam something in my nose and then squirt it into my brain?
Yes, you can, Sarah. We can arrange that.
You know, pound some number two pencils into your nose next. So
how much of that nozzle did you get in your nostril? That's a pretty big nozzle.
He was jamming the whole thing up there.
Are you kidding?
No, I made him jam it farther in. Yeah.
I mean, the big part of the bottle was up my nose there. No, not really. Right. Anyways, I can compare it to body surfing in the ocean and just taking a big old...
Does it feel in your nose like ocean water?
Kinda.
Because, you know, that's no fun. That hurts.
Yeah, it hurts, and, you know, it's just like body surfing and taking a big old sniff.
Does your... Do your sinuses feel any better?
They feel empty, but I still can feel that little bit of a salty...
burn.
You have to squint.
Salty burn.
Well, it's like, you know what they need to do? They need to have two bottles there. One with the salty burn, and you get it all out, and then you just need to squeeze regular water up there.
Do you smell like Febreze again today?
No, I don't.
All right.
Are you wearing your cigar cologne?
I'm going to bring that tomorrow.
The cigar cologne?
Yeah, that way you can take a big whiff. It does not smell like Febreze.
I don't take a big whiff of anything you've got if it's all the same. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Scotty. We want to thank CNN Radio correspondents Jim Roop and Lisa Goddard, as well as Laura Caviezel and Peter Carlin from The Oregonian. The Rick Emerson Show, produced today and every day by the lovely and talented Sarah X. Dillon for AM 970 Solid State Radio. In the news from Tim Riley, RPA is Scotty J. The gatekeeper is Dave Zinn. Tomorrow, we talk with Jen Lane from Barfly Magazine. And tomorrow, 2 weeks away from Listener Party 10, Emerson History X, April 19th at Barracuda. Until then, don't let the bastards grind you down, and please try to help the retarded. Like us next, Stephanie Miller, 6 a.m. to 8 a.m., and Dennis Miller tomorrow, 8 to 11. See you tomorrow, kids. As always, be safe. Thanks for listening. Bye.
I don't feel no ways tired.